playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Hello and welcome to Playback. Fiona Kelly here, standing in for Marion Richardson. On the weekend that's in it, sport, and more specifically hurling, seems like a pretty good place to start. Morning Ireland took a fair and equitable approach with their coverage of the build-up to the final, with reports from both competing counties on Thursday and Friday. The first report was from Marty Morrissey in Galway. One of the places he visited was Josie Hart's pub in Gort. Josie's son Aidan is on the team that hopes to retain its All-Ireland title on Sunday. Marty asked the proud dad how he feels as he watches his son in action.
And do you puck every ball with him? Are you dreading when the ball comes down to his side of the field?
I do, and an odd one before he hits it. Yeah, I do. I most certainly do. Yeah, you'd be a bit biased too, you know, you'd be watching your own. Actually came away from a few matches there and I didn't see some of the opposition players at all until the next day in the paper. But that's the way you'd be, and that's the way all parents are like, you know.
Would you give him advice even now, or would he even listen to you?
We'll take the first one first. Would I give him advice now? Not much, really. But you'd be saying something in the third person, hoping that he'd cash in on it, you know. Take the hint. And he would listen, yeah. He always did.
I'm also joined by Steve Mahon, three times an All-Ireland medalist.
I played in six, actually, 79, 80, 81, 85, 6 and 7. I actually was a sub in 88 because I'd done my cruciate against Waterford down in Fairfield, down in Waterford in 87. So I just got on the subs bench in 88.
I have to smile, Steve, because as you say about the cruciate, you're back rubbing the leg as if you're about to play on Sunday.
Yeah, well, if I met the fella that done it, I wouldn't have rubbed him too handy.
And on Friday morning, it was Limerick woman Petula Martin's chance to step up to the plate.
Limerick, your lady, your shining waters, tears of joy that flow.
Away to 1940, we have Limerick, the All-Ireland champions, the worthy All-Ireland champions.
For a truly memorable game. 45 years is too long a wait for Limerick, a proud sporting county. It's the Treaty City, but no treaty will be signed on Sunday when Limerick take on the Tribesmen.
Keane Lynch is in. Lynch for Limerick, goal!
Who was your love that I
Conor Fitzgerald is a former Limerick hurler. He's married to Aislinn Connolly, a former Galway Camogie player.
We've never been in a situation like this where both teams are in the All-Ireland final. And I'm very passionate about Galway. Conor's very passionate about Limerick. Sometimes we'd be starting a conversation like, oh, I heard this about Galway, and then I'd stop. And he'd be like, tell me, what are you saying? Like, it's a bit of crack. We've a Galway and Limerick flag outside our house.
I thought that I had her converted, but please God, the green flag will be flying outside our house after next Sunday.
Last time Galway and Limerick met in an All-Ireland final, Galway beat Limerick, but you have a family connection. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so in 1980, my uncle was the captain of the team and Dad was on the team, and my uncle Michael was on it, and my uncle Porrick was sub, so three uncles and Dad were on the winning team, and it was the first time that Galway won the All-Ireland for many, many years.
Limerick are going to beat Galway. They won in the league at the start of the year, and they're definitely going to beat Galway, and they're going to win the Liam McCarthy.
An All-Ireland final, a chance at glory. Statement of intent from Limerick hurler Shane Dowling.
This time I really hope we're not just going to get to the final to march behind a band. I want Limerick to go all the way.
From Petula Martin's report on Friday's Morning Ireland, and may the best team win. Brenda Donoghue's Like Family this week also featured a selection of GAA players, but Brenda's focus was on the families behind the players. Amongst those who she spoke to were Ted and Dolores Kavanagh, parents of Tyrone footballers Sean and Colm. Although Sean has retired from playing, Colm still hopes to be lining out in this year's football final. Dolores showed Brenda around her home, which is something of a shrine to her sons, with trophies and medals covering every mantelpiece and sideboard in the house. As you'll hear, Dolores is also something of a story. Storyteller. Have a listen to her regaling Brenda with a tale about her first outing to Croke Park.
The very first game I went to see Sean playing in Croke Park, and the first time actually I was actually in Croke Park. So I sat down and this elderly man was sitting beside me, and I noticed all the people who were with him had flasks of tea and sandwiches, and there we were sitting, and I thought, gosh, these people are so organised. I just wish we'd have brought all this, you know. But this is my first time, and these people had all the flasks and the tea was going round. So this man says to me, "Are you enjoying the game?" And I said, "Yeah, well, this is my first time in Croke Park." So I said, "Do you know anybody on the team yourself?" He says, "I do. I have a son playing." And I says, "So have I." And he says, "Who's your son?" I says, "My son, Sean Kavanagh." And I says, "Who's yours?" "Peter Canavan." The first time I was in Croke Park.
I hope he shared his tea with you.
Oh, he was lovely. Such a lovely man.
And listen to Sean himself telling Brenda about what his success on the pitch meant to his late grandfather.
My grandfather, Tommy Kavanagh, he was a club president of the club here in the Moy, and a huge GAA man, football man, and just a stalwart. In actual fact, one of my greatest memories after winning the 0-3 All-Ireland was bringing Sam Maguire home, and obviously you bring it back to your friends and family. But Grand at that stage, he was 84, and he wasn't in brilliant health. But I just remember having to almost wrestle Sam Maguire off him, and he was incredibly strong, so it was a physically tough moment. But at the same time, I look back at it now with such fond memories, because he was so proud. He had gone to every All-Ireland final in something like 50 years. Him and his friends travelled down. He worked in the railways, and he used to get the train down for as long as he could remember. And it was just that one day of the year everyone went to the All-Ireland final, whether the ticket or not. And being able to bring that back to him. And he was a typical Irish man in that he didn't like to show emotion. And I never saw any emotion of him through my whole lifetime until that moment where I can remember seeing the tears in his eyes. And I remember thinking to myself, even as a young lad, I was 19 or 20 at that stage, that, you know, that I had really made a difference to his life, even at the very, very end of his life. He passed the following year. So it was just amazing to have that memory, that I was able to bring a cup home to a man who had spent his whole life going to Dublin and following the likes of the Kerrys and the Dublins and the aristocrats of football of Down and whatnot, winning this trophy.
Sean Kavanagh talking to Brenda Donoghue last week on Like Family. Another Irishman who told a story on air this week about his grandfather's devotion to the GAA was Dermot O'Leary, well known to television audiences here as the former presenter of The X Factor. He was a guest on last week's Second Captains, and at this point in the interview, he talks about how himself and his dad basked in the success of the great Wexford hurling team of the 1990s.
Well, when Wexford had that great team in the 90s that only won one All-Ireland but got to a few Leinster finals. And at the time, I was working as a runner in television, and so a researcher, and I'd fly over on the Friday or the Saturday with my dad, or I'd meet my dad over there, and we'd go and we'd stay in Dublin and we'd watch like Wexford play. So that kind of great mid-90s team that ended up winning the All-Ireland, I got to know them and support them like quite intimately.
I've heard you describe your upbringing in the past as very Irish. So how Irish are we talking?
Yeah, yeah.
How Irish?
I mean, unless you've moved away and you've got kids, I suppose, it's quite difficult to explain that, especially at the time in the 80s. It was very distilled, I suppose. So when you shut the door outside, it just felt like, you know, I went to a Church of England primary school and a Catholic comprehensive school. But as soon as you shut the door, it felt like a very Irish household, with my mother's influence and my father's influence, and you know, the crucifix up, and it felt like a little bit of Ireland sort of, you know, brought to the UK, which I suppose you could say with any immigrant or diaspora's kind of household, you know, that kind of. I always describe myself as I'm Irish, but not from Ireland, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like I said, it's a very kind of bottled and distilled, concentrated Irishness, I suppose. Now, it's weird. In one respect, I had an Irish passport since I was a kid, and I've never had a British passport. And I don't hold that as like a badge of honour or anything. It's just something that happened. They never sort of forced that identity down our throats. It just felt very natural for us. And I think because of that, they assimilated very well to the kind of the UK society as well.
I did hear a mention of a ban on watching foreign sports. Well, instigated only, I think, by your granddad, to be fair, not your parents.
Oh, yeah.
But I mean, this extended to, you know, even the most Irish of, like, athletics was banned in your house.
Yeah. If granddad was there and football was on, that was it. We couldn't watch the football. And then, and I like, you know, I love football, and I loved, I probably love playing rugby more than any other sport. I couldn't watch rugby, and then it was, I remember once we were watching athletics and they were coming, yeah, turn that foreign muck off. I'm like, it's running, it's just guys running around the track.
Dermot O'Leary, as heard on Second Captains last Saturday. A short clip there from Áine Ní Gallagher's report on Morning Ireland on Wednesday, which marked the 20th anniversary of the Omagh bombing. In an interview afterwards with RTÉ's Northern editor Tommy Gorman, Gavin Jennings asked Tommy why Omagh stands out as the most awful day in the history of three decades of violence in Northern Ireland.
I suppose people had thought at the time of the Good Friday Agreement that this was the magic moment. It was so hard for people to reach what was the decisive negotiation. It involved compromise. There was international effort. That happened in April of 1998. And people thought that things were going to change from there on in. And I suppose that maybe explains why Omagh was so unprepared for what happened on that August day, 4 months later. It's a very good market town. It had a history of good relations. It also had the tradition of cross-border shoppers, people who might come to the Omagh Folk Park, and that's what actually happened on the day. And I think it was because of that, because it was such an assault on people's sense of fairness and their sense of hope. And then the innocence, the way in which people were caught. You know, the bomb warning was given, the phone call was made some 40 minutes beforehand. People thought they were moving away from trouble, but it was so perverse that they were actually being directed towards the source of the bomb. And then if you just look at the ages of the people who were killed, they were ordinary local people. They were visitors. That terrible detail of the woman pregnant with unborn twins. It was, I suppose, one of those most base moments you could have in a civilised society.
Tommy Gorman talking to Gavin Jennings on Wednesday's Morning Ireland. Later that morning, Miriam O'Callaghan spoke to Kevin Skelton, whose wife Philomena, or Mina, died in the bombing. Kevin described how himself and Mina were out on a shopping expedition with their daughters. He'd wandered into a different shop full of ornaments and household items, while Mina and his daughter Shauna had remained trying on shoes in a neighbouring shop when the bomb went off.
As I turned to come out, Mr. G's, the bomb went off. The front of the shop was called out, blew out, or sucked out. I walked right after it. And I can still see it this bouncing up the walls, in, out, and out. The cosy corner, as we knew it then, folded like a book, the front of it in like a book. Slevin's Chemist on the other side of the road, just the front of it came out like someone you've seen Commando. And once it hit the break in the bridge in Campsie, everything went dead. And I went in through the window that was left, the window with Kales, and I found her lying face down in the rubble. I lifted her arm. I could find nothing, but I knew Shauna had been standing near her mother. I didn't know where Tracy was, but I knew Shauna had been standing near her mother, and I couldn't get her. I thought she was buried underneath her. And you were pulling at stuff and lifting things, trying to find out. Then the first fireman that came in was Paddy Quinn, who I knew well through me refereeing me football. He played fullback for Omagh St Enda's. When he lifted her arm and he dropped it, I knew she was gone. But I thought Shauna was gone too. and you were taken out by the police, but I kept coming back up the street again. And then and one of the times he came in, I found Tracy on her knees beside her mother, a 15-year-old girl on her knees beside her mother. You know, she's seen an awful thing that day, but the hardest part of it would have been for them. Paula thought we're all dead. I thought Shauna was dead. I knew Tracy was alive. I thought Paula was dead. Tracy thought Paula was dead, you know, and Shauna was dead. It wasn't for hours afterwards we realised that we had only the one fatality. That I found Shauna out in the hospital in Oma, getting ready to go in a helicopter to go to a healthy Galvin. But, you know, the thing that sticks with me, and I will carry it to my grave, no matter what I do in life, and my life has changed a lot, is the smell and the cries of pain. The smell of burning flesh and the cries of pain. That's something nobody can take away from me.
Kevin Skelton talking to Miriam O'Callaghan on Wednesday. Michael Gallagher also lost his 21-year-old son, Aidan, in the Oma bombing. He featured in Oniony Gallagher's report on Wednesday's Morning Ireland.
It's a difficult day looking back, really difficult and painful, but I think we've got a great crowd of people here that was affected at the time, and also other victims' groups from around the country, and I think that helps. It's very tiring after 20 years and no one's been convicted, and that's a great difficulty in Oma, because everybody, you know, right across Ireland felt that this was the most wicked and evil crime that we had seen in our history, and we were sure those responsible would be caught.
As Michael Gallagher mentioned there, nobody has ever been successfully convicted for the Oma bombing. On Wednesday's News at One, former police ombudsman Nuala O'Loane told Christopher McKevitt how she believes that there needs to be a public inquiry into the police handling of the bombing and the intelligence gathering operation. She spoke about how, in the lead up to Oma, there had already been 7 bombings in Northern Ireland that year, and how the special branch had received information in July about the activities of dissident Republicans.
Some of that information, which we know came into the police, we actually found the original intelligence sheets. There were 2 critical pieces of information where the intelligence sheets were not to be found. Now, on the 4th of August, a telephone call was received by a police officer, and it was a very specific call. It had quite a lot of detail in it, and it said that there would be an attack on police in Oma. It named individuals, it talked about guns, etc., etc. And that call was taken very seriously by the police officer who took the call. He drove immediately to Oma to communicate it to his special branch superiors. He acted absolutely correctly. It went into special branch. Now, under the force orders, what should have happened was that it should then have been communicated to the subdivisional commander in Oma, entered in the Oma threat book, and then some reaction provided, some considered a measured reaction. There was no communication, as far as we could establish, with the subdivisional commander in Oma. He was informed after the bomb exploded that there had been a threat. We could never find the threat book, the Oma threat book. I don't know why. But we do know that the evidence is that he did not know. Had he known, what could or what would he have done? Well, my anticipation is that he would have taken some kind of preventative action, that the police in Oma would have taken some kind of preventive action, and that would probably have involved checkpoints, because that's what they did when they thought something was on the move, when they thought there might be an imminent threat of a terrorist action. And there were, and have been since, cases where bombs were abandoned, just abandoned on a roadside because it was too dangerous to get them into where they intended to take them to. And I think that might have been what might have happened. And, you know, in saying this, I know it's difficult to hear, and I know that the Chief Constable criticises me for traumatising the Oma people. This is not to traumatise the Oma people, because I believe we need an inquiry so that it doesn't happen again.
Baroness Nuala O'Loane, as heard on the News at One on Wednesday. Margaret Cash hit the front pages of a number of national newspapers last week when she posted pictures of her children sleeping on hard metal benches in Tallaght the station. A week down the line, the mother of 7 spoke to Miriam O'Callaghan about her experience of being homeless.
Well, I've never been in a council property. I've never had my own council house. So I suppose I was in the caravans most of my life. And then when my baby started getting a bit bigger, I moved into private rented. I was homeless a couple of years back as well, but a man from Focus Island, Sean Logue, who now works in Tala Council, helped me get the last house that I was in. But basically what happened was, love, I was in that house for 3 years, and then the landlord ended up, the banks ended up repossessing the property. They ended up taking the property back off of her, which left us homeless. So that's what happened.
And that night you ended up in Talagar, the station, was that the worst night, or had you been homeless with all your little children before?
Yeah, I've been homeless. I've been homeless for the last year, you know what I mean? Like, it's there's no, you don't understand that they kick you out at 9 o'clock in the morning. Do you know what I mean? Like, and you can't go back. You're sitting around waiting. You can't ring the phone. You can't ring the free phone till half to half three, right? You ring them at half three. They don't get back to you till after half eight, 9 o'clock in the night, sometimes 10 o'clock. Then they tell you whatever hostel to make your way to, whatever part of the country you're in. Do you know what I mean? And then you're back up at 8 o'clock in the morning, getting the kids ready and out the door by 9 again. That's it. You've nowhere to go. Walking the streets, wandering the streets all day again till half eight, 9, maybe 10 o'clock that night again.
When you went public, there was a lot of political reaction. Politicians were all coming out saying it was terrible. But did anyone actually contact you, any politician?
No. No. Simple as that, no. Never heard or never seen none of them. No, because they don't care. God, if I could only get into it all for a minute till I give them a piece of my mind. I really would, and that's the truth.
What would you say to them if you got into the doll?
I don't even want to say it on live radio what I'd say. Oh God, I've an awful lot of anger for them, that's all I can say.
Margaret Cash is heard on The Today Show on Thursday. Another parent in the news this week was Michael Jacob, father of Deirdre Jacob, whose disappearance was upgraded to a murder investigation by Gardaí this week. He spoke to Krista McKevitt on Tuesday's News at One.
Even though we were aware of the progress that the Gardaí were making and that this was about to happen, but nevertheless, when we were listening to it over the airwaves and on the TV this morning, it still came as a shock, just hearing those sort of words that Deirdre was murdered. You know, it's a real heart-wrenching situation.
Had you been reconciled to this some time ago, or had you held out hope that she may be living and out there, just inaccessible to you?
We always held out hope that was the case. You know, it's probably just how one reacts. You always look for a glimmer of hope. But as I said, now with the investigation going in this direction, obviously it's a difficult time.
Because you and your family, you've spent more years searching for Deirdre than the number of years that you actually had her in your lives.
Indeed, that is the case. Deirdre was 18 when she went missing, and that was 20 years ago.
Do you feel closer today than you might have felt in years gone by to getting the answers you so desperately want?
We hope we are, but over those long 20 years, there were other times when we felt there was some information coming in that would make a difference, and the investigation went in several other directions, and particularly early on, there were many new directions, but now at this time, there's this new information coming in, and obviously we have to try and encourage whoever has that information to bring it forward. We're hoping, in actual fact, we know with the goodness of people out there who have information, they may have held on to it for a long while, but at this point, they might feel it's good to come and talk to the Gardaí.
Michael Jacob, as heard on Tuesday's News at One. Louise McEntee will be well known to listeners of Liveline as a mother who campaigned tirelessly and ultimately successfully to have her son Liam brought home to Galway, having spent the first 4 years of his life in Our Lady's Hospital in Crumlin. Louise was Catherine Thomas's guest on The Ray D'Arcy Show on Monday. She told Catherine how the Make-A-Wish Foundation has transformed her family garden into a place where Liam, 3 years on, can continue to thrive at home. When Liam was born, weighing less than a pound at the age of 23 weeks, doctors gave him little chance of survival, but despite several serious operations, complications and the amputation of one of his legs, Liam defied all the odds. But as well as having to mind Liam, Louise told Catherine the heartbreaking news that she has also had to come to terms with becoming a carer to her husband Sean, who at the age of 54 has developed dementia.
We had Liam home about 6 months, and unfortunately he was diagnosed with frontal temporal dementia and Parkinson's. And now he's not able to do anything. I was hoping he'd be my rock when I got home and give me a hand with Liam, and the way any normal couple would be with their baby. But it ended up that I was looking after Sean and Liam, and the boys, they were terrific. I wouldn't have been able to do it without them the last couple of years. Fíochna and Cormac gave up their job to help look after Sean and Liam at home, even though we had carers for Liam. But Sean's, we kept Sean at home for as long as we could. And unfortunately, a couple of weeks ago, we had to admit him into a nursing home. So it's very emotional time. And it's something that he's only 54 years of age, and it's something that we shouldn't have to go through either, you know.
Yeah.
But it's there in front of us and we have to live with it, and we're coping the best way we can with it.
Were there signs that, other than the fact that it was sort of distraction, yes, were there signs, or was there any hereditary markers or...
Well, Sean was brought up in a children's home, so we never knew his family history until he got sick there a couple of years ago. And we found his brother that he hadn't seen in a few years, and he actually told us that his mother had Pick's disease. And Pick's can only be diagnosed through a post-mortem, so that's the only reason we know now that it's frontal temporal dementia, and it is Pick's disease. It is a dementia, and it's very progressive. And... we tried to look after him at home, but we just couldn't anymore. His cares outweighed what we were able to do for him. So we had to make the very hard decision to let him go to the home for somebody else to look after him the best way they could.
And when was that, Louise?
3 weeks ago, just before the opening of the big reveal on Neame's Garden.
Before he went in 3 weeks ago, Louise, did he know who you were, or had it deteriorated?
He mixes up Fíochna and Cormac, and he got to the stage where he doesn't even know Liam, because Liam isn't in his memory where he remembers. We think Sean remembers around his early 20s, but Liam kind of, he'd walk past him and doesn't really see him as his own, do you know?
Mm.
So it's very sad for Liam too. He's lost his daddy in one sense, and Sean has lost a very happy little boy looking up to him.
The remarkable Louise McEntee talking to Catherine Thomas on Monday. Another inspirational person heard on air this week was Dubliner Mark Early, who lost his beloved wife Leanne last year. Leanne suffered from epilepsy since her early teens, and she died in her sleep from sudden, unexpected death from epilepsy. Leanne had just started a new job in Loughlinstown Hospital weeks earlier, which was why she wasn't with Mark at an overseas wedding at the time. Mark told Ryan Tuberty on Thursday about how he received the news that Leanne had died while he was waiting in an airport in Melbourne to board a flight to Abu Dhabi.
I got a phone call from her sister Jane, and I was in the airport on my laptop, and I'd noticed Leanne hadn't replied to, you know, on WhatsApp you can tell if a message has landed or not, and I'd noticed it hadn't landed, and I thought maybe she's had a lie-in, maybe, I wasn't sure, but I hadn't thought too much about it, and I got the phone call from Jane telling me that she was dead and that she'd passed away in her sleep, and, you know, I collapsed. There was a wonderful French family beside me, and they kind of scooped me up off the floor and realised there'd been a phone call of some magnitude. And
what was going through your mind?
I don't know. Like, I needed to be around people. I needed to talk to somebody who knew her. I needed to make sure that this has actually happened. You know, I think my first thought was maybe it was a mistake. Maybe Jane had made an error, or maybe somebody had misread it. And I just wanted to get home as soon as possible. You know, I wanted to be with my folks. I wanted to be with her family and my friends. And arrived at the gate in ribbons, you know. And the woman at the gate was loath to let me on the plane. She was, you know, in hindsight, doing her job, making sure I was fit to travel. But
you were a state.
I was a state. Like,
of course,
I could hardly stand up.
You got on the plane.
So I got on the plane knowing I was getting to Abu Dhabi.
You're sitting in this plane.
I'm sitting on the plane. I've nothing, like, I can't contact anyone. I've just had these three phone calls that are, you know, the worst phone calls of my life. And I just had my phone out with the notes application open, and I started to write down memories. I just through floods of tears, I started writing down anything I could think of. I had an immediate fear of losing everything we'd had together in terms of memory, in terms of experience, in terms of
You were worried the hard drive was going to be wiped.
Yeah.
So you start writing things down into your phone as it were.
And it slowly became, the word eulogy doesn't sit with me for some reason, but it became a tribute to Leanne.
What were you writing? What were the first things you prioritised in your memories?
Like describing her. I just wanted to describe her.
Do that for us now.
as
much as you can.
It's, well, I suppose I'm slightly biased. I think she's the most beautiful woman who ever, you know, walked the earth. She's a stunning blonde bombshell. She had a big open face, a big smile that warmed people. She was very open and friendly, and she was a carer. She looked after people. She's a whole group of friends who went through all sorts through their lives, and Leanne was often the first one to get that phone call, you know.
Mark Early talking to Ryan Tuberty on Thursday, and you can find out details of Mark's blog called There Are Words on the Tuberty Show website. Grief of a different hue was also expressed by Caroline Mulwani when she rang into Liveline on Tuesday. She spoke to Joe about the recent death of her mum, who died unexpectedly after a sudden illness. Caroline's mum had been living alone in a council house on the Navan Road in Dublin.
My mum passed away on the 13th of May. Between one thing and another after she passed, with day-to-day stuff, I had my son's graduation and another son's confirmation and so on. I had a lot going on, but, you know, back and forth to the house, we tried to get what we could from our house, but I was under a lot of stress, and I was told that I had loads of time not to worry. I went back to the house.
It was a council house.
It was a council house, yeah. I went back to the house on Sunday, and her locks were changed, and the house was cleared. All her belongings were gone. And it was bad enough that I thought somebody had been in there and touched her stuff and taken her stuff. Mm-hmm. I found out yesterday that they had dumped everything and destroyed everything, and they never contacted me to tell me this, that they were going in. They never contacted me to say, mm-hmm. you know, you have X amount of time. Nothing. It was just done.
And is it that the council went into your mother's house and just saw maybe that there wasn't much to throw out, and they presumed these aren't personal items?
No, everything was there. Everything personal. Anything to do with a home that you can think of that a mother, a grandmother would keep. You know, there was a rocking horse for my kids that she had left for my granddaughter. Mm-hmm. It was a wooden old antique one. There was an old antique sewing machine that belonged to her mother. It was one of them Singer sewing machines that was there. There was my, you know, sentimental things like my trophies that I'd won as a child. You know, anything that you can think a mother would display was out there. It was very obvious that it was a home.
Photographs,
oh yeah. Still photographs on the walls, and you name it, it was there. Things belonging to my grandmother on my mum's side, things belonging to my grandparents on my dad's side, the clothes my dad died in, everything. And I'm waiting to find out what dump they went to. I just want everything back. It's all I had left of her.
From Tuesday's Liveline. And unfortunately, although Dublin City Council apologised to Caroline for their mistake, they haven't been able to locate any of the sentimental items which Caroline and her family have lost. John Boyne was Brendan O'Connor's guest in the Marion Finucan Show studio last Saturday. During the course of a very honest and moving interview, the best-selling author spoke about how, after the breakup of his 11-year relationship, he attempted to take his own life.
I haven't actually talked about this before, but it was one of those long, dark nights of the soul. You know, it was a Friday night where everything really had just caught up with me. I knew that my ex was seeing somebody else. I knew there seemed to be no way back. And I was distraught. I mean, I was absolutely distraught. I loved him, and I guess still do, very deeply, and felt very worthless and very alone. And nothing else, like the books, everything like that, you know, just didn't seem to matter at all to me, you know, without him there beside me. And it was probably not that serious in the, well, I mean, it was serious, obviously, but it wasn't in the sense that basically, you know, for everything that I took, you know, within half an hour, I was phoning an ambulance. Okay. So I dare say, you know, subconsciously, it was a cry for help. It was, you know, it was, I wasn't going to throw my phone out the window or something. Ended up in hospital on that and took a long time. Something I'm sure many people listening to this would have had moments like that maybe in their lives, and you don't do something like that or experience something like that without it changing you in some very deep way.
I bet. How did it change you?
It made me feel that it made me feel very worthless, to be honest, and I still kind of feel that way. I felt that because he wasn't there even when that happened.
Author John Boyne talking to Brendan O'Connor on the Marion Finucane Show last Saturday. Noel O'Connor was a guest on the Today Show on Thursday. You might remember that the entrepreneur had a successful outing on Ireland's version of Dragon's Den a few years back when she received backing for her tan organic product from presidential hopeful Gavin Duffy. With her product due to launch next year in the UK, Noel also recently took part in the BBC version of the show. She told Miriam what we can expect when the programme airs tomorrow night.
It was quite difficult for anybody to do Dragon's Den. It's enormously difficult and it's quite, you know, a pressure and pressurised. And when BBC rang me and asked me to do it again, I was like, no, no way. I'm not doing it again. But they convinced me, you know, to do it. And I remember saying to the researcher, you know, this feels like having a baby for the second time when you swore you'd never do it again.
The pain is just as bad.
And it was more difficult, I think. Not my business. Emotionally, I found it difficult.
I know you can't tell me how you did because you'll be killed and it's going out on Sunday night. But for you personally, you got quite emotional, didn't you?
I did. I'm not shy. I can talk. But when I walked in, I don't know what happened. I don't know whether it was post-traumatic stress from the first time. There was a few minutes. And of course, the pitch is 3 minutes long. So that was the 3 minutes I was in this. I can only say it was like a state of trauma. When I asked myself, what happened when I went in there?
Because you were crying, were you?
I struggled to get through my pitch. I did get through it. I did get emotional through the pitch. And I'm disappointed with myself. Aww. Because, you know, it's going out on BBC, all of the UK.
Telly gold, of course.
I gave them TV gold, absolutely. But look, that's what I put myself up for. Aaron, who's my life partner.
Yeah. He appeared with you.
He appeared with me. Bless him. He had no clue what it was going to be like. I did try and tell him. And he said, nothing could have prepared me, Noel, for that. And he was great. He was solid, brilliant. And it was me that was weepy.
Was there any difference between the Irish and UK versions? I mean, apart from they have a massive audience, obviously so many more people in the UK, but is there a difference?
I came out and I said, the Irish dragons are pussycats towards those guys in there. That was the exact thing I said. And we'll just have to wait and see. I'll be hiding under the stairs on Sunday night.
Businesswoman Noel O'Connor talking to Miriam O'Callaghan on Thursday. Ballymun-based performance poet turned playwright Colm Keegan was in the Arena studio on Wednesday talking about his play For Saoirse, which is due to run at the Dublin Fringe Festival next month. Here's a taste of what you can expect.
A taxi finally stops and I jump in. The taxi man is one of those silent, surly sorts. It suits me grand. I'm at the crossroads, manic and mad out of it in one direction, sleepy and drunk in the other. I don't want to talk. He takes the usual route, swinging away and looping around the Liffey. I rest my head on the window glass. I love this drive home at night. All the landmarks tipping the hats. Looking so much nicer for being lit up in the dark as I lie there feeling all snug inside the cab. It's a journey that never gets old. The city in movement. Everything spooning along outside. Roll up, roll up. For the latest instalment in your favourite showreel. Dublin as seen from a car. Here's the granite swish swish, the rise and the dip dip of the walls of the Liffey, the whip whip of the amber lit streetlights. Here's the lofty authority of history singing from the pillars of the GPO. Here's the spire, the Pierce Monument. There's the salt and vinegar sting of the Kingfisher Chipper as we're overt in the rotunda and on we go. The slow trundle over ramps, over tarmac, that peels back here and there to expose sweet cobblestones, the bare bones of the city. Here's the shadowy gloom of the black church, the buckety shop and flat gleam of the Set Street, the ancient green leaf field of Drumcondra rolling over the trickle of the Tolga round by home farm to home turf, the long road with the park in the DCU, the wide open vibe of the Ballymun Road, the Sean's Elysee of my youth. Might sound pretentious, but it's the truth. Where seven giants used to loom up from the horizon in my time and place, in my landscape, Ballymun.
Eric O'Brien performing an excerpt from Colm Keegan's play For Saoirse, which will debut during this year's Dublin Fringe Festival. Another writer heard on Radio 1 this week was Stephanie Prisner, best known as the writer of the TV show Can't Cope, Won't Cope. She's also the co-presenter of Situationships, a six-part series on Radio 1 on Thursday nights, which she's currently presenting alongside her best friend, Rachel Yoder. Stephanie was in for a chat with Catherine Thomas on Monday, and she was just back from a trip to LA and was still buzzing about the success of Can't Cope, Won't Cope in the US.
So exciting. So, it was on Netflix.
Yeah.
And then on Wednesday, it was in the New York Times watch list, which is amazing. And
when you were over there.
When I was over there. And then I had to do an interview with Entertainment Weekly, which I, like, maybe I'm meant to be, like, playing it real cool and being like, yeah. So then but I was so excited. I was like, hello. I happen to be in LA. So that was so exciting. And also then my podcast.
Is it kind of surreal that, like, it's getting great reaction? It's
very surreal, yeah.
Because you wrote, it's two series. Because everyone was like, why isn't there a third? When it's coming back? And you went, you know what? I want to go out on a high with this. You hadn't even sort of in your head gone to
No, I hadn't
two
even gone to season two. And I'm listening to Harry Potter at the moment. And I'm like, how does J.K. Rowling know at the start that Harry is a Horcrux? Sorry for the spoiler if you haven't read it, but like it's just the four, like, but you know, even now with Paramount, like I'm working with producers who have like Promethean foresight, so they're like, this needs to be a returnable series, you know, how do we finish that storyline into season one and season two, and we haven't even started writing the first part of it. So, you know, it's about, I think I was just so excited with Can't Cope, Won't Cope, I didn't think it would get made, let alone have a second series. So I didn't want to.
And can I ask you, sorry for butting in, when you started with Can't Cope, Won't Cope, is that just you in your room,
yeah,
solo, going, you know, look inside your head, having the crack and putting it all down?
Yeah, which the Americans can't get over either, because they usually have a whole writer's room, but it's just me and my laptop. And I actually wrote it in the Mater Hospital cafeteria because no one interrupts you there. And then I used to get staff discounts.
Why does no one interrupt you there?
Because, first of all, if I sat at one of the chain cafes writing my TV series, I'd feel like such an awful stereotype that I just couldn't cope with that. And then otherwise, I feel if it's not one of the chain stores, I feel bad taking up a seat while I'm only going to buy one coffee. So hospital cafeterias are just the perfect balance and also close to my house. So that's where I wrote Funk Up season one and two.
Stephanie Prisner and Catherine Thomas having a laugh on the Ray Darcy Show last Monday. That's about my lot for this week. To play us out, here's Irish soprano Sinead Campbell-Wallace, accompanied by Aoife O'Sullivan on piano, singing O Mio Bambino Caro. So until next week, goodbye.